Greetings, comrade, and welcome to Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com.
Wow, that was a bold choice. I like it.
Thank you. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me as always is a man suspected of working for the Soviet Union.
Mike DiCristio.
How you doing?
I thought
today,
we agreed we weren't going to talk about that.
Well, you're only suspected.
Yeah, you know, allegedly.
Even if you are, I'm sure there are a lot of legal loopholes into that whole can of beans.
I leak film news back to Russia via this podcast.
Yeah, Russia already knows the plot of Star Wars Episode 7.
Yeah. But you're going to have to wait until December, so sorry.
All right. Now, if you've never listened to a film bookcast before, essentially we start with some film news, and then we usually move on to some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever media we've been consuming lately. After that, we will move on to our featured review. This week, we are reviewing the newest film from director Steven Spielberg, Bridge of Spies. Are you ready, Mike?
Yes, I am.
Good. Let's get this train rolling.
It'd be awkward if I wasn't ready.
Yeah.
That would be one of these days I'm going to say no.
No, you're not ready. 2 minutes into the podcast start.
Yep.
Nope, not ready.
No, yeah.
You just shut off the Skype call. Call back like an hour later. Be like, okay. Yep.
All right, we can go now.
All right. So film news, we got a bunch of stuff to get through today. It's going to be a very packed podcast, I think. So for film news, first item on the list, there's a lot of Marvel stuff happening in the past 10 years, and also in the past week or two. Recently, Marvel announced a sequel to Ant-Man, Ant-Man and the Wasp, dated 2018. And Peyton Reed, director of the original Ant-Man, is probably going to return. And presumably he won't drop out at the last minute and be replaced by somebody else.
Unless he drops out and Edgar Wright comes.
Now that would be,
that would
quite
be
a twist. That would be quite a twist. But this is cool because Ant-Man and the Wasp was not a movie that I think a lot of people thought was going to happen. Ant-Man was a very Ant-Man made money.
Yeah.
But it was a pretty minor hit for Marvel, comparatively speaking, to you know, the rest of their stuff that makes like billions and billions of dollars.
Yeah, I guess that's true, but it's a much, I mean, the movie itself is like much lower stakes. Like,
yeah,
that's kind of interesting.
Yes, it's a much smaller movie and it had a much smaller budget than most of Marvel's movies. And so that's what allowed it to be a hit. And supposedly this will be kind of the same thing. And plus, Ant-Man, at least, will be appearing in Civil War.
Yeah.
And, you know, let's not rule out appearances in other movies as well. So it's entirely possible that, like, more people will be going to see Ant-Man and the Wasp based on him appearing in Civil War and other Marvel movies.
That's true. Yeah, I never thought of that. I mean, it's exciting. I mean, the way the Wasp was introduced, like, you knew that she was going to be a thing.
Right.
So it's cool that she's going to get her own movie, in air quotes, but
right. This is going to be the first Marvel movie that has a female hero in its title.
Yeah.
Which is exactly cool. Like, but, I mean, she's sharing the title with
Ant-Man.
With a male hero, but still.
Yeah.
Progress.
Now that Perlmutter's gone.
Yeah, and now the Perlmutter's gone. Yeah, that's like, yeah, it's actually, like, Perlmutter's gone. This is, like, one of the first things they did as soon as he left. So that's interesting.
Although they did push back Captain Marvel for it, but
they did, but they pushed Black Panther up. So,
yeah.
You know.
I'll take it.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's Ant-Man and the Wasp coming out in 2018 means that Captain Marvel got pushed to 2019, which is unfortunate, but, you know, is the way it goes sometimes. And now,
I think we get three movies that year now.
Well, that was already going to be the
case. Oh.
Starting in 2017, we're going to have three Marvel movies a year.
My God, the future is bright.
The future's so bright.
Yeah.
We got to wear shades.
Nailed it.
And this is cool because the Wasp was in Hope Van Dyne, Evangeline Lilly's character, was set up as the Wasp in Ant-Man, the movie, which we reviewed a few months ago. Mm. And, like, I enjoyed her character in the movie, but she does virtually nothing. And one of my big complaints about that movie was that it was all lead up to the Wasp appearing in a later movie, whereas she could have easily been the Wasp in this movie.
Yeah.
And the movie and her character would probably be better for it. And so it's cool that now that's actually happening, even though we had to do a whole movie of setup for it.
Yeah. I mean, that her whole character in that movie is, I'm ready now, just let me do it.
Yeah. But she's not getting that chance. And then at the end of the movie, she gets the spoilers for Ant-Man. She gets the suit and she's like, about damn time, and the movie ends.
Right.
And yeah, Peyton Reed, director of the original Ant-Man, is probably returning. He's in negotiations, I think, at this point. And that's cool. you know, that's he did a really good job with Ant-Man, and so I'm excited to see him being able to do something that is fully his, because there was a lot of turmoil behind the scenes of the original Ant-Man. Again, right. Edgar Wright was originally supposed to direct that movie, dropped out. The script, if you look at the screenwriting of that movie, it's like Edgar Wright and Joe Cornish and Adam McKay and Peyton
Reed. Yeah, there's a ton of people.
Yeah. So it's cool, Ant-Man and the Wasp, I'm excited for, and it did push out Black Panther a little bit a few months, so that's coming out in like February 2018 now.
Right.
And so that's exciting. It's cool.
Yeah.
Also, Marvel news, smaller stuff, but still pretty major. So Captain America Civil War has pretty much every Marvel character that's ever existed. And yep. Several that didn't already. In fact, if you look at the cast list of Captain America Civil War, you'll find that the only two people that aren't in that movie are you and me.
Wow, I wasn't expecting that.
But yes. Also... but also Thor and Hulk. And the reason for that is because Thor is getting his own movie.
Right.
Thor Ragnarok, so he doesn't really need to be in Captain America Civil War, because you can just see what he's up to, you know, on his own time.
We can make a billion extra dollars if we make him in another movie.
but Hulk is all standing there all alone without his own movie.
Yeah.
You know, the last time he made his own movie, it didn't do too well for Marvel.
Yep. They pretended it didn't exist for a long time.
Yeah, that's true. Now they're kind of bringing it back to the fold a little bit because they're bringing William Hurt back into Captain America Civil War.
Yep.
But now Hulk is going to be joining the cast of Thor Ragnarok. Mark Ruffalo is reprising his role as Bruce Banner for that movie, which was very surprising.
Yeah, that's pretty cool because, I mean, I don't read the or haven't read the comics, but don't historically Thor and Hulk like have a bromance or a rivalry?
I mean, you know, maybe. I do read a lot of the comics, and I can't think of many times where I've seen Thor and Hulk interact with each other.
All right, I made that up. That's fine.
But maybe you didn't. Like, there's 50 years of comics to go through. Like, I'm not going to sit through each one.
What, Mike, why don't you know everything? Come on. But it is pretty sweet, though, that he's going to be... I mean, it's not his own movie, but I assume he'll have a large role.
Yeah, it seems like it's going to be a major supporting role. And, you know, that's very cool. I think it's an odd pairing, for sure. I think Thor and Hulk, it's like... I mean, Mark Ruffalo's Hulk has only been in the two Avengers movies, plus the post-credit scene of Iron Man 3.
Right.
But you don't really see him interacting with Thor that much.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be fun to, like, see those two characters kind of, like, on their own solo adventure kind of thing.
Yeah, because, I mean... at the end of Age of Ultron, I don't remember, but Thor is gone. Like, he left Earth, right? Or is he still there?
I'm pretty sure Thor is gone. I mean...
I know he does it at the end of the first Avengers also.
He does leave at the end of the first Avengers. I think at the end of Avengers 2, he's basically just going back and forth between Earth and Asgard. Spending, like, I'm pretty sure he's still on Earth, because he still's got that relationship with... Jane at the end of Thor 2.
Oh, right.
I don't think he would just abandon her. She's not in Avengers 2.
Right.
So that's definitely, you know, you might miss that. But
I don't remember. Yeah. But I feel like he was going to investigate whatever happened in that pool with the scene they cut out that they shouldn't have cut out.
I think he was going to investigate more of that. And the Hulk is also gone at the end of Avengers 2.
Right, yeah.
He goes off to be a big Hulk and little plane.
And right. Oh my god, I forgot about that. so whatever. He's going to be in Thor 3. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's neat. And supposedly, I was reading about Thor Ragnarok. Apparently, it's not really going to take place on Earth or Asgard that much. It's going to be on, like, this alternate plane of reality, or, like, this different planet.
On Planet Hulk.
Maybe. You never know.
Possibly.
This could set up Planet Hulk. I mean, Marvel has denied the Planet Hulk was a thing, like, for a really long time. Like, that they're developing it. Not that it didn't happen.
It's like, wait, what? But, in the movies, you mean?
Yeah, they've been denying for years that was going to be the case. There's rumors for a long time that Hulk's going to show up in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, and that's going to be, like, a Planet Hulk movie.
Right.
But that is not the case. So, you know, I'm excited. You know, Hulk and Thor, Ant-Man and the Wasp. Civil War's coming out.
Yeah, I mean, basically, we talk about it every time Marvel's news comes up, that we're in love with it, so.
Pretty much. I mean, I feel like, you know, that's really all there is to it.
Yeah.
Like it's sort of exhausting keeping up with all of it, but at the same time, like I'm into all of it, so you know, whatever.
Let's get on to our 10 other pieces of news.
Let's get on to some more pieces of news. So there was a lot of news recently about directors jumping onto new projects. So I thought I would mention three of the ones that stood out to me. F. Gary Gray, director of the recent hit Straight Outta Compton, and also director of the movie Friday, The Italian Job, Law Abiding Citizen, is going to be directing Fast 8, which is the eighth film in the Fast and Furious franchise. I'm really disappointed.
The first of the last trilogy.
Yeah. Yes, the first movie of the last Fast and the Furious trilogy.
Yep.
One last trilogy. So that's exciting. And then Robert Rodriguez is going to be directing Alita Battle Angel, which is a movie that's been in development for years under James Cameron, but it seemed like it was mostly abandoned because of his work on the Avatar movies.
Right.
And then Len Wiseman, who directed Live Free or Die Hard, is going to be directing Die Hard Year One, which is a prequel to Die Hard.
Yeah.
Featuring Bruce Willis in like bookend scenes.
Yeah.
Like, the beginning and end of the movie. But it's mostly going to be about a young John McClane in 1979 before the events of the first Die Hard.
Right.
So of these projects, which of these sounds the most appealing to you?
Appealing, I guess the Robert Rodriguez one.
Okay.
Because I don't know anything about it. And the other two I'm not excited about.
You're not excited for Fast 8?
No, because James Wan's not directing it.
That's fair, because James Wan was amazing and did a great job directing Furious 7. But,
yeah.
You know, I've really enjoyed Fast 5, 6, and 7. I have no reason to think they'll drop the ball with 8.
That's true. That's a good point. Although, you're right. I always forget that franchise has left Earth. It doesn't take place in reality anymore. And they own it now. Like, they're aware of that.
Oh, so. Yeah, absolutely. And I can describe Alita Battle Angel to you. I have a plot synopsis of the con. It's based on a Japanese manga.
Okay.
And I can tell you a little bit of something about this. So
tell me.
The story concerns a cyborg in the 26th century who is saved from the scrapyard by a cybernetics doctor. He restores.
Right, say no more. I'm in.
There's more.
Oh, okay.
He restores her and names her after his deceased cat, Alita. The cyborg Alita recalls nothing about her past, but does remember a legendary cyborg martial art called Panzerkirst. She becomes a mercenary hunter-warrior, tracking down dangerous killers while simultaneously attempting to recover her past. The film will be an action-adventure following Alita on a journey of self-discovery and love.
Yes, I'm in. Yeah. Sign me up.
Yeah, I would love for Robert Rodriguez to get on
this. That sounds like a Robert Rodriguez movie, not right. A James Cameron movie.
I would love for Robert Rodriguez to get on this and just knock it out of the park. His last several movies I have not been a big fan of. You know, his last three movies were Sin City 2, Machete Kills, and Spy Kids 4. Yeah. And actually, to be fair, I didn't see Sin City 2. I've heard it's not very good.
Yeah, I didn't see that either.
I have seen Spy Kids 4 and Machete Kills. And
why did you see Spy Kids 4?
You know what, man?
All right. Yeah, you're right. I'm not going to judge you. That's fine. That's cool. Hopefully, this seems more along the lines of something that he's familiar with, I guess.
Hopefully. I'd like for him to kill it. Because the last Robert Rodriguez movie I really liked was probably Planet Terror in 2007.
Right.
So it'd be nice to have a good Robert Rodriguez movie again. I've been hearing about this movie for years, like since before Avatar came out. You know, James Cameron has talked about this movie. He bought the rights to this so long ago with the intention to direct it.
Mm-hmm.
And like I've been hearing about it for so long, it's so weird that like James Cameron's not doing it. But at the same time, like as he got so much more involved with making Avatar sequels that have so far not come out.
Yeah.
That's you know, it seemed less and less likely that this movie was going to happen. So it's cool that he's just giving it off to Robert Rodriguez to direct it.
Mm.
So I don't know how soon this is going to happen, because Robert Rodriguez is also attached to the Johnny Quest movie, as we talked about a few months ago back in the podcast.
Oh, yeah, he is.
So I would rather this happen than the Johnny Quest movie, but you never know.
Yeah, that's true. Although I am kind of excited about, well, I don't know if excited is the right word, but Die Hard Year One. I read Film School Rejects wrote an article about how in order to make that movie actually work with the Die Hard universe, he has to be like a piece of shit in this movie because, you know, at the beginning of Die Hard, he's an asshole that Holly moved across the country to get away from. Like,
right.
So, like, he has to be the bad guy, basically.
Yeah, I mean, Die Hard Year One sounds like the worst possible idea for a movie.
Yeah.
Not even just for a Die Hard movie, for, like, a movie in general.
Any movie, yeah.
Like, A, it's a prequel, and prequels are usually really tough to make work. And then they can work. You know, Better Call Saul is awesome.
Yep.
Loving that show. There was another Wet Hot American Summer, I'm thinking of.
Yeah. same caliber.
Yeah.
Same type of show.
Exactly. Like, those are the only two good prequels. And
They were saying in order, the basic gist is that he has to be, you know, like a corrupt bad guy cop, and the movie has to be about, like, the good guy, and, like, we meet John McClane.
Right, but do you think that's going to be the case? I don't think it is.
I don't think so, but I want that version. So, like, I'm not excited for it, and I don't really have any faith, but,
It's gonna the description that I read was that it's gonna be about John McClane as he becomes the man that he will be in Die Hard, which is ridiculous because
so he's gonna be a good guy, be a bad guy, and then be a good guy again.
Well, here's the thing: the appeal of the original Die Hard and the sequels basically jettison this, but the appeal of the original Die Hard is that he's just a regular guy.
Yep.
Who got caught up in these extraordinary circumstances, and so Die Hard Year One is gonna be like him being this awesome, like, badass.
Right.
Probably. And
it should just be him being, like, a traffic cop.
The entire movie.
Yeah, just him, like, really normal shit going on. And then Die Hard happens.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. It just seems like it completely misses the point of the original Die Hard. Like, nothing remarkable was supposed to happen to John McClane until...
Until Die Hard.
Until Die Hard. And then, I mean, after that, like, he's not... After that, those sequels, like, completely missed the point of the original Die Hard 2. Not the original Die Hard 2, the original Die Hard.
Also. Not Die Hard 2, Die Harder.
Yeah,
Die Hard 2.
So, you know, it's that movie just seems like a train wreck. And it's directed by Len Wiseman, who directed Die Hard 4, which...
Everyone knows is the best Die Hard.
Exactly. He also directed many of the Underworld movies. If you listen to the Comedy Bang Bang podcast, Paul F. Tompkins has a character where he plays Len Wiseman, and he just talks about the Underworld movies and how he's married to Kate Beckinsale, and it's really funny.
That's awesome.
But in any case, those are the three movies I want to talk about there. I'm excited for Fast 8 because I love I'm really digging those movies. I think F. Gary Gray is a pretty solid choice. I mean, Straight Outta Compton was a huge hit for Universal, so it makes sense that he's on board for this new Fast and Furious movie. And he also once directed Vin Diesel in a movie called A Man Apart in 2003. So, you know, he has as well. So, you know, that should be cool. Should be interesting. Let's move on to one of our next stories.
Keep them coming.
Yeah, let's keep these film news going. So Quentin Tarantino, you may have heard, is coming out with a new movie called The Hateful Eight.
I have heard of it.
Yes, I'm pretty excited. I was like Porky Pig for a second there. Did I tell you that I saw the trailer for The Hateful Eight?
Yes, you did. You finally saw it.
Yeah, I had not seen the trailer, and I saw it before I had seen something. And it looked pretty awesome. But
it looks great.
But the thing about The Hateful Eight is it's going to be coming out in theaters, but it's also going to be coming out in 70mm CinemaScope in select theaters. So not in widespread, like not in your local Regal theater, but if you go to like certain movie houses or student or independent theaters, they will be showing The Hateful Eight in 70mm. And according to Quentin Tarantino, the version you see in 70mm will be different from the version that plays in regular theaters.
Yeah, it will.
So apparently what the difference is going to be, there's going to be 6 extra minutes of footage in this version, which brings the clock in at 3 hours and 2 minutes.
Yes.
For The Hateful Eight in 70mm. That does not count a 12-minute intermission that will be happening in the 70mm version. Yeah.
That's awesome.
And it's going to be a, like, roadshow version of the film, like how they would do in, like, the old days of film, like in the 30s and 40s. So there's going to be an overture and it's like what? Before the movie starts, and you know the movie will go, there'll be an intermission, and you know he's talking about how it's going to be different, and he's saying that the regular version of The Hateful Eight will not be inferior, it's just going to be different.
Right.
So several scenes, he's saying that several scenes that unfold in The Hateful Eight in the 70mm version are going to be in these big, long, cool, unblinking takes that might be cut up for the wide release.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So, like, a quote from Tarantino, he says, the shot was awesome in the bigness of 70, but sitting on your couch, maybe it's not so awesome. So I cut it up a little bit. It's a little less precious about itself.
He says. That's the most Tarantino precious about itself. That's what that.
Yeah, he goes on and he's like,
I'm sure.
It's actually really funny. The 70 is the 70. You've paid the money. You've bought your ticket. So you're there. I've got you. But I actually changed the cutting slightly for a couple of the multiplex scenes because it's not that. Now it's on Showtime Extreme. Or you're a hot dog on a stick and you just want to catch a movie.
What?
Yeah, and this is from the AV Club article. Is like he says this, a curiously specific comment, presumably providing insight into his daily routine.
Oh, that's awesome. But yeah, I'm excited because in theory, you and I will be able to see this in 70mm in Manhattan.
Yes, hopefully. Yeah, I think we're both I'm planning to come visit you, and we're going to go see The Hateful Eight in 70mm, glorious 70mm CinemaScope.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I saw... the Ziegfeld Theater, which is a movie, you know, one single screen, giant movie house in Manhattan. I saw The Master on 70mm there.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that they'll have, I would assume.
I'm sure they will if they have The Master in 70mm.
Yeah. So that'll be really cool. And then I didn't know that we're going to get this whole experience.
Yeah. So it's exciting. And I think I definitely like to see both versions if I can get it if I can. I mean, I'm gonna go 70mm first because that sounds more up my alley, but but they both, I'm sure they're both gonna be great.
Yeah, we're the kind of people that version is made for.
Exactly. Yeah. Precisely. All right, and then after that, next film news story, Godzilla versus King Kong is happening.
All right, moving on.
Yeah, that movie's dated for 2020. So that's 5 years from now, so it's kind of hard to care about it right now. But
yeah,
Warner Brothers and Legendary have kind of teamed up and created this monster universe. So yeah. Godzilla, the 2014 movie, is like the first movie in that universe. And in 2017, we're going to get Kong Skull Island, which is going to refer to that movie a little bit from what I hear. Like there's going to be references to this shady government organization in that movie or whatever.
Yeah.
And so that's going to be the King Kong movie. And then a year after that, 2018, we're going to have Godzilla 2, which
Pacific Rim 2.
God willing. Yeah. Godzilla 2 is happening with Gareth Edwards returning, so that's very nice. Cool. And then Godzilla vs. King Kong date of 2020, which, you know, should be cool.
Hopefully.
I like monsters. I like Godzilla. Yeah. I like Godzilla. I like King Kong. Like, that's cool.
Yeah, I like stuff blowing up. That'll be sweet.
Again, 5 years from now. Like,
who knows what'll happen.
But, it's crazy to me that they're so far not including Pacific Rim in all this.
Yeah.
Because it's owned by Legendary. They can do it.
How could you not?
And how could you? Like, Pacific Rim even poses the idea of, like, alternate realities. So, like, even if it doesn't take place in the same universe, like, Jaegers could just jump in through a time portal or something and, like...
Right. Just go through the rift.
Like, if we're doing a Godzilla vs. King Kong movie, like, logic's out the window. You can just go do that. Like,
just do whatever you want. Yeah, I think they just have it out against Guillermo del Toro,
yeah,
as we mentioned last time.
Yeah, have you gotten to see Crimson Peak yet?
No, I have not.
Yeah, neither have I. I've been meaning to, so...
I've been hearing good things.
Yeah, I've heard very good things, so I'm going to check it out soon. But, yeah, right now, Pacific Rim 2, as we discussed... previously is not on the table right now, but
it's on that list of 10 years things.
Yeah.
Not yet. We haven't named yet.
We're going to get around to the name in 10 years. Yep. I mean, Pacific Rim 2 could happen. Like it's not, outside the realm of possibility, but it's also not looking great. But in any case, Godzilla vs. King Kong, date of 2020. And now finally our last bit of film news. And, basically this bit, there's this big science fiction franchise, maybe you've heard of it, it's kind of a cultural phenomenon, it's called Star Wars.
more of a space opera.
More of a space opera. And this past week, assuming you weren't on the internet at all over the last week or so, you may not have noticed that a new trailer for Star Wars came out. Well, first, a new poster for Star Wars came out the day before the trailer.
The IMAX poster, right?
And it's the official theatrical poster.
Oh, yes, you're right. Yeah, they released both.
And it's a great poster. I think it looks awesome. It's the background of my phone.
of course it is.
And the day after that, they debuted the new and final trailer for Star Wars The Force Awakens.
Who are you?
I'm no one.
I was raised to do one thing. But I've got nothing to fight for.
Nothing will stand in our way. Finish what you started.
There are stories about what happened.
It's true. All of it. Dark side. A Jedi. They're real.
The Force. It's calling to you.
Oh, it's the last one. Thank God.
Supposedly, well, it's only the third trailer.
Yeah, that's good. I'm glad we're not going to get four more between now and December.
Exactly. They don't need them. Is the thing.
That's exactly.
The marketing team for Star Wars: Force Awakens is doing an amazing job with this movie, and so
all they had to do was be like, "This movie comes out on this date, and everyone is going to see it anyway." Like, they don't need to market this.
Like, this movie comes out on this date. Star Wars, Han Solo's in it. Like, this trailer could have just been like a black screen for 2 minutes with the word Star Wars on it, and this movie would still make like $1.5 billion.
Just the still frame of old Han Solo. That's it.
So anyway, the Star Wars trailer came out. It premiered during Monday Night Football.
Yes.
Did you watch it during the football game, or did you watch it online afterwards?
Well, here's the thing. So we've discussed, Jeff Cannata's unsullied movement of not watching trailers outside of, what you see in theaters or on TV.
Yeah.
And I've been doing that for a while recently, and it's actually really cool. It's like a weird thing to like go into a movie not knowing anything.
Right.
Really.
Yeah, and I generally try to do that as well.
Yeah. So I knew the trailer was coming out on Monday. I did not know it was going to be premiered during Monday Night Football. I thought it was like going to be released online.
Right.
So I was like kind of avoiding the internet a little bit, and then I was like watching the Giants game. And the next fall, they were like, "Stay tuned for halftime for the premiere of the Star Wars trailer," and I was like, "God damn it!" So I had intended to not watch it, but accidentally watched it.
That's funny.
And then once I was like, I heard that, I was like, "Well, I can't change the channel now, so yeah. I'm already here. I might as well watch it." And I'm glad I did, because it was an awesome trailer.
Yeah,
and
it's great.
It avoided a lot of the traps of trailers of, this is what's going to happen. And it's mostly just like, hey, look, it's Star Wars shit.
Yep.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, I also watched during Monday Night Football, but not because I would have been watching Monday Night Football anyway. Yeah. I was one of the many who was watching this specifically for the Star Wars trailer. I think it's really funny that a bunch of nerds with no interest in football had to watch...
I'm pretty sure,
two quarters of football just to...
I think Jonah Ray tweeted, the comedian, and he tweeted, premiering the Star Wars trailer during Monday Night Football is like the jock throwing the nerd's comic in the girl's bathroom and saying, go get it. That's amazing. Yeah, it was such a weird way to place that.
Yeah. But it worked. I mean, it was a huge... the trailer premiere was huge. And they also, in addition to the trailer premiere, tickets went on sale.
Yeah.
That night at 7 p.m.
They showed those servers the wrath that is the Star Wars fan.
Yeah, Movie Phone crashed, Fandango crashed. Basically every ticket site crashed immediately. And, you know, it's already broken, like, pre-order box office records. This movie is still 2 months out.
And it's breaking records.
Yeah. Have you gotten your tickets yet?
No, I didn't even try.
Yeah, I mean,
I knew I wasn't going to get them, and I'm not sure. I mean, going for a midnight release for this kind of thing would be awesome. But I'm not sure I want to go to a sold out theater. You know, I want to.
Well, here's the thing. There's whatever the theater, like, there's going to be more showtimes open on the opening night. And, like,
yeah.
Like, I actually looked up the tickets for my theater, and they only had, like, 2 showtimes available. So there's going to be a lot more as we get closer to the date. So I'm not too worried about it.
What did we see? Was it Guardians or Avengers that we went to midnight showing of?
Both.
Both? All right, yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, we went to both.
Went to both, yeah. Like, that, I mean, Star Wars falls into that, like, where the fandom and, like, it's it's, like, respectful, I guess. Like, it's a lot more fun, and everyone's excited to be there at midnight, whereas opposed to, like, you know, going to another movie at late at night or with a sold-out theater is always the fucking worst because everyone's talking and who's not paying, like, yelling shit at the screen, and, like, it's a little different for a midnight premiere, I know, but...
All right, yeah, I feel you. But, like, the trailer, what did you... I mean, you said you liked it. You enjoyed the trailer.
Yeah, it really laid the feels on thick. Which was nice.
Yes, I think part of what's really interesting about this trailer is that, you know, it implies that everything that happened in the original trilogy has fallen into, like, myth and storytelling.
Yeah, that was so cool.
And that Han Solo, of all people, is the guy who's, like, like, relaying the story and telling you what happened.
It's all a bunch of tricks.
Yeah, like, in A New Hope, he's the guy who's like, I don't believe in any of that stuff.
Yep. Yeah,
hook your religion, ancient weapons, no match for a good blaster, you sad kid.
Yeah, it's really cool. I did see somebody on Reddit, or at least I saw it on Reddit, cut all of the scenes of... I kind of wish they hadn't done it, but Oscar Isaac flying an X-Wing and, like, that whole thing, like, the X-Wing's flying over the lake or whatever's going on there.
Yeah,
cut them all together from the 3 trailers. And it looks awesome. It's, like, clearly an X-Wing attack on a Stormtrooper base, and it looks fucking cool, and I'm really excited for it.
Yeah. But, yeah, this is supposedly the final Star Wars trailer. So that's good, because they don't need to advertise this movie anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm glad, like I said, too, all of the trailers so far avoid any, like, hints at what the story might be. Like, we don't need to know. We don't need it to see this movie.
We have not even seen Luke Skywalker yet.
Yeah,
that is the thing. Exactly. That's something people are, like, really, like, noticing. Like, where the hell is Luke? Like, what's happening?
Yeah, he saw his hand one time, probably. Maybe.
And so that's, like, that's crazy to me that Luke, like, they haven't seen Luke. But this marketing is kind of brilliant because it's focused almost entirely on the new cast members.
Yep.
You know, they have short appearances from Han Solo. In this trailer, you see a brief glimpse of Princess Leia.
Yeah.
And you see R2 a couple times, you see Chewie, but for the most part, it's mostly focused on the new people. And that's great because, like, they really have to sell these new guys is what they have to do. Because
you can do it.
Most likely.
I know it's Star Wars, but take a breath.
Most likely what's going to happen is that, you know, the old cast members are not going to want to stick around for many movies, possibly even any more movies after this one.
Yeah.
Or
not be able to.
Or not be able to.
I don't know.
You know, you never know what's going to happen. So you got to sell these new guys so that, you know, you have the old cast members in this movie, and that's awesome. But, you know, you have these new characters that we're introduced to in this movie, and you want to make sure that we're, like, invested in them and, like, want to know these characters so that when episode 8 rolls around and, like, Harrison Ford's not available...
for whatever reason.
Yeah. You know, I'm still subscribing to the belief that Han Solo may die in Force Awakens.
Yeah, like it's totally possible.
I think he might, because that's Harrison Ford's been wanting Han Solo to die since Return of the Jedi, so it could happen.
It's possible. But yeah, I'm glad that they are focusing on the new cast members, because like you said, they want it to be a new hope. No.
a new trilogy, a new, like,
yeah, like a new for the next generation of fans.
One last trilogy.
Oh no, I said next generation talking about Star Wars. No, what have I done? But like, that's what I mean. That's it. I gotta go, guys. But it's been fun. But like, you know, for the new generation of fans, like, I mean, it's obviously for the fans that are lifelong fans, but they want to attract new kids, like new.
Yeah. And they're doing a great job. They're doing a great job attracting new fans as well. The Star Wars Rebels TV show is a huge hit.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's, you know, this cartoon show on Disney XD. I've actually seen a few episodes of that, and it's pretty good.
Yeah, I've heard. It's on Netflix, I think, too. Or one of them. One of their series is.
The Clone Wars is on Netflix. I know that.
That's right.
And that was actually a pretty good show, too. That's, again, I've only seen a few episodes of that, but I enjoyed what I saw. The brand has been kept alive, any case, like with kids, with those two shows. And, you know, they've always had video games and stuff. The new Battlefront's coming out. Mm. In November, I think. The beta just came out, and a bunch of my friends got it and said it was great. So
yeah, I think it just closed. Yeah. Like, it just ended.
But
yeah, that'll be new.
Yeah, so that is that's Star Wars. You know, what more is there to say? It's right. It is Star Wars. You know, and so forth. I'm just so excited for The Force Awakens. I think when that movie comes out, like, obviously we're going to review it. But I feel like we could just do an entire episode that's just us talking about that movie.
I'm not against that.
Yeah, like,
that would be kind of cool.
We could skip film news, skip discussions, and just do, like, straight up 2 hours about Star Wars: The Force Awakens.
And we could do it too.
I don't doubt that. Like, I think we definitely could.
Tweet to us and let us know if you want us to do that to the four people that listen to this show.
There are humans, man. There are humans who listen to this podcast.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. You got your Dungeons and Dragons friends.
Yeah, exactly.
I got my pals who listen to it.
At least three.
Yeah. Now, we average, like, somewhere between, like, 50 to something-ish.
Oh, look out, world.
Yeah. It's not bad.
No, it's pretty good.
All right. In any case, that is the Star Wars trailer. That is it for our film news. We finally made it through. It took us about a half hour.
Yeah, that took a long time.
But in any case, let's move on to our discussions for the day. So, Mike, why don't you start us off?
Sure. So, I'm going to be... Or the thing I wanted to discuss today is Fargo Season 2. Just started about on airs on FX Monday nights at 10 p.m., I believe. Yeah, 10. And it's just started. I think it's only aired its second episode of the season. And you watched the premiere, right?
I've seen the first episode. I haven't seen the second one yet. Yeah.
Till the first one. Okay. Yeah, it's good. So it takes season one, which takes place in the present, modern, you know, present day. Basically.
Right, 2006, I believe that takes place in.
Yeah. Relatively present.
I watched season one pretty recently, so it's...
Oh, okay. Yeah. There you go. But there's a case referred to in season one by one of the characters' fathers, that when he was a cop, this, you know, the occurrences of season one reminds him of that. So season two, we flash back to 1979. I think that's actually a really cool way to do it. Because, like, I got my parents to start watching season two, but they haven't watched season one.
Okay.
And they're not really that lost.
Yeah, they're not missing anything, because it's an anthology series, basically.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, it's pretty neat if you didn't watch season one, you don't have to worry about it.
Right.
Just know that it...
But if you have watched season one, there's stuff in there that you can be, like, recognized from season
one. Yeah.
Like, the main character, Patrick Wilson's character, is a character from the first season.
Right, yeah. And, like, Patrick Wilson's character's daughter in this is like 6 or 5 or something like that.
Right.
And
she's the main character.
She's the main character in season one. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the only connection that you have to make to enjoy this. And it still nails the very Coen Brothers, just like weird as shit thing they have throughout all of their work that season one had also.
Yeah.
Like season two, the opening like 5 minutes is supposed to be the black and white outtake of a Ronald Reagan film of the director standing in an open field talking to a Native American actor.
Yeah, that was great.
It was awesome. Like, it was really great. It's still really funny in, like, an awkward kind of way. So it's cool. It's hyper graphic. I can't believe they like can do all the stuff they do on this show on FX. But it's pretty neat. I think people should watch it. And I'm having a lot of fun with it. It's one of the, we talk about it. This certain, surge in TV shows that excite the film buff in me.
Yeah.
which is great.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cool camera work. There's like split screens and weird shit happening.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of talk about peak TV lately. Like if you follow a lot of TV critics, they've been using the phrase peak TV to refer to like, there's so much good TV on right now.
That we're about to pass it and it's going to go back down.
Well, it's like literally impossible to keep up with it all, is I think what it's saying.
Yeah.
It reminds me of like the Simpsons where...
just like everything else reminds you of the episode of the Simpsons.
There's an episode of the Simpsons where Marge is complaining to Homer about something trying to spend time with his kids, and Homer's like, it's not my fault, Marge. It's these television studios. They're producing quality show after quality show after another. If they'd just slip up once... give me a half hour to myself. But they won't, Marge. They won't let me live.
That's how it feels. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I've been watching, like, so many of my favorite shows have come back in the last couple of weeks, and I feel like all I've been doing is just trying to keep up with them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've been watching Fargo, but I haven't seen the second episode yet. I've been watching The Leftovers, which is awesome, and everybody should be watching that. The Flash, which is arguably the best show on TV.
Whoa.
I'm being a little hyperbolic, but at the same time, I'm not. It's The Flash is
great. It's kind of like how Furious 7 is the best movie of all time.
Yep.
But like, kind of not.
Yes, exactly. Seriously, though, everybody should be watching The Flash. It's so good. Last Man on Earth is back. Brooklyn Nine-Nine is back. I've been watching South Park. I've been watching Moonbeam City, which is this really... Have you seen Moonbeam City?
No, but I've... I subscribed to the Archer subreddit, and everyone was just like, this is an Archer ripoff.
A little bit, but it's also really funny. It's like this, it's like...
I mean, I've seen, like, the commercial, like, the trailer for it.
Yeah, it's like a parody of, like, 80s cop shows. It starts with Rob Lowe as a character named Dazzle. it also starts Elizabeth Banks, Kate Mara, and Will Forte.
Wow.
As any hardcore listeners of this podcast would know... a pretty big Will Forte fan. And so it's cool because I can see Will Forte on Sunday with Last Man on Earth. And then on Wednesday, I can see him on Moonbeam City. But it's,
there you go.
It's pretty
great.
So
you feel warm and fuzzy.
Exactly. Also, Saturday Night Live is back. And I've been watching that. Have you seen any Saturday Night Live this season?
No, I haven't. I saw the debate skit, which was amazing.
With Larry David as Bernie
Sanders.
That was amazing. Yeah, that was part of the Tracy Morgan episode, which was a phenomenal episode.
Yeah, I felt like such an idiot. I was hanging out Saturday night, and then it, like, happened, like I was on my laptop, and then it was like, oh, it's 2 a.m. Forgot to set the DVR to watch Saturday Night Live. Oh, well.
Yeah.
So I missed that one.
But it was a great episode. Tracy Morgan was amazing, and it was great to see him back in action after his accident.
Yeah.
This is, like, his first time really, like, doing any kind of public comedy, so mm-hmm. It was really cool and was really funny. And he brought back, Brian Fallon's Safari Planet, Astronaut Jones. He brought back Woodrow, which was a character I didn't expect to see back. So do you even know who Woodrow is?
I don't think so.
It's a sketch. I think he only did the sketch once back in, like, 2002.
Okay.
And it's actually this very sweet sketch where it's like I think Drew Barrymore was the host or Kate Hudson. Kate Hudson was the host.
Mm-hmm.
And Tracy Morgan was this homeless man named Woodrow who just, like, sings to himself. And he and Kate Hudson have, like, a duet at the end of the episode where they sing a song. It's like that. It basically ends to, like, a shit joke. It ends, okay. It ends on that.
Sounds about right.
And the big joke at the end of the song is that they sing the words doo-doo pie. but he sang it with Kenan Thompson in this episode. It was pretty great.
That's awesome.
It's also a 30 Rock reunion.
I heard about that. I haven't seen it.
As a huge 30 Rock fan, that was pretty amazing. But in any case,
Fargo at all.
Yeah, that's not Fargo, and that's not any of my discussions. So let's.
Yeah. So what are your discussions, Mike?
So my discussions. I wanted to talk about a couple things. First off, yesterday, another thing where if you were not on the internet, you may not have heard of. Yesterday was Back to the Future Day.
It was.
Yes, and so the reason it was Back to the Future Day is because. In Back to the Future 2, October 21st, 2015 is the date that Marty travels to when he goes to the future. Right. And so now everything in the Back to the Future trilogy officially takes place in the past.
Whoa. That's deep.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was fun to be on the internet yesterday, but like, we don't have hoverboards. I get it. Like, that was everything on the internet. Was that and that Biff is Donald Trump. I'm like, okay, I get it.
Yes. I mean, people were mentioning that, like, you know, we don't have hoverboards, we don't have this, we don't have that. But at the same time, we have computers in our pockets. right. And access to all of the information in the world.
Ever, yeah. You and I are doing this hundreds of miles apart.
Yeah, and we are video conferencing right now, which is something that Back to the Future 2 had.
Right, right.
So there is that.
So we're close.
Yeah, but so in celebration,
and the Cubs are out of the playoffs also.
Yeah, yeah. In Back to the Future 2, the Cubs win the World Series, and it was kind of funny. The Cubs made it as far as they did. yeah. Like everybody was like, "Oh my god, Back to the Future 2 could happen."
Yeah, that would be crazy.
So in celebration of Back to the Future Day, me and my dad went to the trilogy marathon at the local Galleria Mall. And it was a lot of fun. You know, I've seen the Back to the Future movies many, many times, and specifically the first one, which is one of my favorite movies ever. Yeah. Seen so many times, and yet I still notice things in those movies that like I hadn't seen before.
Really?
Yeah.
That's
like,
awesome.
Especially the first one, which is so like densely packed. Like,
yeah.
Everything that's set up in the first movie, it pays off in some way, and it's such a perfectly structured screenplay. And so like even like. Like something I hadn't noticed before, but the car at the end of the movie that is in Marty's garage, shows up, he hadn't had before, but it's there now,
right.
after all his time travel adventures. It's the same car that he was eyeing at the beginning of the movie, when he's talking to Jennifer, and it's something I had never, noticed before, and it's like, wow, I'm still picking up on stuff in Back to the Future, after seeing it, 50 times. Like,
yeah, that's awesome.
And Back to the Future 2 and 3, I think, are very good, are movies that I like a lot, but they're not as good as the first one. I think it is funny that we had a whole day celebrating the weakest of the Back to the Future movies.
Yeah, it's pretty...
I'm gonna throw...
wait a second, hold on. You think Back to the Future 3 is better than Back to the Future 2?
Absolutely.
Wow, okay. All right.
I mean, I guess that's kind of that's a harsh debate. but I think Back to the Future 2 is a lot of fun.
Yes.
But I think it's a very unfocused movie, and it's, a lot of stuff in Back to the Future 2 sets up payoffs that happen in Back to the Future 3, and right. Those are effective in 3, but in 2 they kind of feel superfluous. But also in 2, like, there's, three different time periods they go to, and it's like,
right.
Like, they're in the future for a half hour, they're in alternate 1985 for a half hour, and then they're in 1955 again for a half hour. And right. I feel like if they had just chosen one and stuck with it, like...
Right.
It might have worked out a little bit better.
Okay. I see what you're saying.
And specifically because, like, the future stuff is fun, but it's totally inconsequential to the rest of the movie.
Right.
The only thing that matters in the future is that Biff goes back in time with the sports almanac.
Right.
Right? Nothing else that happens in the future is relevant to the rest of the movie at all.
Right. And that Biff is, like, an asshole or whatever.
Yeah. So.
But that happens across all time.
Yeah.
That transcends.
Yeah, the Tannen family is forever destined to be covered in horseshit, I guess.
Yeah. I guess, basically.
Yeah, I remember a couple years ago they came out with Back to the Future the Game, which was like a Telltale Games thing. You know the guys who did the Walking Dead games?
Yep.
Before they did that, they came out with a Back to the Future game, which was like co-written by Bob Gale, who wrote the movies. And I only played like a demo of the first episode, and it seemed kind of fun, but... Mm-hmm. From what, like, it takes place, like, 6 months after Back to the Future 3, and, like, I guess you go through, like, a different time period every episode. It's, like, 6 episodes.
Right.
And in, like, every one, you face off against an ancestor of Biff Tannen.
That's awesome.
Which
yeah,
is pretty
I mean,
funny.
Yeah, I haven't, I mean, I've seen those movies tons of times, but they're one of those, things that, like, I don't own them, but, so, like, I haven't seen them in, like, their full unedited... Like, I see them on TBS all the time. Like, one of those kind of things. Like, they're those movies.
Okay,
I haven't seen that.
Yeah, I have the 25th anniversary Blu-ray of...
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan. I really
like, they're totally worth owning, too. Like, they're great.
Yeah, and so I think it's actually pretty funny, too, that, yesterday Back to the Future was playing in theaters all across America, meaning that it probably made more money than The Walk. in its entire theatrical run.
Yeah, probably.
Poor Zemeckis.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't even know that was that they were doing that, that they were going to have it in theaters. And then I went to see Bridge of Spies yesterday, and I was like, huh, look, it's there. You got Back to the Future.
Back to the Future. Yeah, and there was actually a surprising number of people in my theater. Like, it wasn't really promoted or anything, as far as I can tell.
It just kind
of
happened.
Just kind of happened, and there was a decent amount of people there. So that was cool. So yeah, that was just a fun marathon to do, because I'm a big fan of Back to the Future, and yesterday was Back to the Future Day, so...
There you go.
Why not celebrate it with some style?
Nailed it.
I was quoting Back to the Future there. Why not time travel with style?
Oh, I had a fun... So yesterday, I was watching the Mets game, and somebody had a sign at Wrigley Field that said, "Mets, make like a tree and get out of here." And my mom was like, "That's not how that goes." And I was like, it's Back to the Future Day. Come on. Like, she was like, "What are you talking about?"
That's really funny. Yeah, I do want to mention my favorite. Like, Back to the Future 2 may be the weakest of the three movies to me, but it does have my favorite line reading of any of the movies, which is when... it's from Biff, and it's when old Biff shows up in his car.
Okay.
And old like, they're in 1955, old Biff is there, and he says something to Biff, and Biff's, like, walking to the car and just, like, stares at him for a minute. And then he just shouts, "Get the hell out of my car, old man!" And it's, like, it's the best. It's my favorite line in, like, any of the movies.
That's great.
And another discussion I wanted to bring up. So a few weeks ago, we reviewed the new M. Night Shyamalan movie, The Visit.
Mm-hmm. I remember.
Which you were not that big of a fan of, but I enjoyed very much. And that discussion, you know, we mentioned some of the other M. Night Shyamalan movies that he's made, Sixth Sense, Unbreakable, Signs, The Village. And I've not been a big fan of a lot of his work, but when I was a kid, I saw Sixth Sense and I saw Unbreakable, and I liked both quite a bit. So I decided to go back and watch Unbreakable, because I hadn't seen that in a really long time. And it doesn't hold up as well as I thought it might. That's not totally fair. There are some really great scenes and sequences in this movie, but I think it's really brought down by its constant need to over-explain everything.
Yes.
Do you know
what I mean? I haven't seen that, or I haven't seen it in a long time, so I don't really remember. But from what I remember, isn't that, like, a secret superhero movie?
Yeah.
So, like, maybe it falls victim to, like, it's a superhero movie before that was a thing?
Maybe. I mean, it has a very dour tone. I think that mostly works for it. Basically, it's the plot of Unbreakable is that Bruce Willis discovers that he is unbreakable.
Right.
Well,
he signed me up.
At the beginning of the movie, Bruce Willis is in a train crash, and he's the only survivor, and he cuts out without a scratch.
Right.
And so everybody's like, wow, this is a miracle, whatever. But also, like, you know, it becomes clear throughout the movie that, like, he's never been injured in his life, and he's never even realized it.
Right.
Never been injured, never been sick, and his only weakness is drowning, which, spoiler alert, is everyone's weakness. So,
fair enough.
So there's dumb stuff like that that is kind of yeah. annoying. But on the flip side of that, you have Samuel L. Jackson's character, who is has this rare bone condition where his bones break very easily, and right. So he's... You know, he's, like, sort of a cripple, and he's, like, kind of... But he's a comic book collector, and he's, like, obsessed with the idea of, like, good versus evil and morality and stuff like that. And he becomes, like, the opposite of Bruce Willis's character, and they meet up several times throughout the movie and tries to explain to Bruce Willis, you know, what's happening to him and, like, how he is unbreakable. Yeah. And at the end of the movie, Bruce Willis does, like, you know, the superheroic stuff, sort of, like, he saves these two girls from being kidnapped. And there's the twist ending at the end of the movie, which I will spoil. But the twist ending is that Samuel L. Jackson is secretly a villain. And the thing is, it's a very obvious twist ending. It's a good concept. I like it. But it's a very obvious twist ending because at the, like, halfway through the movie, Samuel L. Jackson, like, starts talking about how the fact that they're polar opposites and, like, how, you know, you can't have one without the other. And it's very much like a Batman and the Joker kind of dialogue. Right. And it's like, but I like the idea of it. It just gets, like, the reveal of the twist just goes on for so long. You know, it's revealed, like, Bruce Willis has this ability to, like, touch somebody and see all the terrible things they've ever done. And so when he touches Samuel L. Jackson, he sees that Samuel Jackson's been orchestrating all the events that, like, resulted in, like, the train crash that caused Bruce Willis to be the only survivor, that kind of thing. And so like that gets revealed, and Bruce Willis is like, whoa. And then you have like another additional 2 minutes of Samuel Jackson saying like don't you see that we are that we are completely polar opposites? We cannot exist without each other.
Right. And like, we got it already.
And there's so many times in this movie where I'm like, I get it. Like, like there are things in this movie that just go on for way too long. Like when Bruce Willis is discovering his powers, he's lifting weights with his son. Mm-hmm. And like the son like keeps putting on more weight, like against Bruce Willis's the wishes. But then like Bruce Willis is like, wow, did you put more weight on? Let's keep going. And like they puts on like another 25 pounds. And this scene goes on for like a long time. Like,
right.
It basically shows you, Shyamalan shows you like every time that he puts on more weight, and it's,
yep. It's like, we get it.
And by the end of it, like he starts off at like 275 and the scene goes on forever. And he's only at the end of it, it's only like 350. and there are really good scenes in this movie, but I think it's really brought down by this, like, over-explaining,
right.
This need to over-explain everything and to drill it into your heads. And so I gotta say, The Visit is a better movie than Unbreakable, and I'm gonna take that to my grave.
Wow. All right. That'll be on your headstone.
So, yeah.
Thought The Visit was better than Unbreakable. R.I.P.
And a bunch of film geeks are looking at it like, what the fuck is he talking about?
Yeah. Who is this guy?
So I have not seen The Sixth Sense since I was a kid either, but I feel like I don't want to go back to it
just to preserve. Just let the nostalgia wash over you.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like The Sixth Sense might still hold up.
I get the feeling that one probably does.
Then again, I thought that about Unbreakable too, so.
That's true.
Yeah. So, I guess on that dour note, yeah, why don't we move on, Mike? Let's move on to our featured review of Bridge of Spies.
They've got our guy, our spy pilot. They've got their spy. We want you to negotiate the swap.
I'm an insurance lawyer.
Are you good at what you do?
This will be a first for the both of us.
You should be careful.
Do you know how people will look at us? The family of a man trying to free a traitor?
Every person matters.
Why are we hanging him? He's a spy!
We need to know what the Russian is telling you.
We're not having this conversation.
Don't go Boy Scout on me. We don't have a rule book here.
We call it the Constitution, and that's what makes us Americans. Where do they want this negotiation?
East Berlin. People in my country consider this an act of war.
The next mistake our governments make could be the last one.
Standing there like that, you remind me of a man when I was young. Our house was overrun by border guards. And this man, my father's friend, he was beaten. Every time they hit him, he stood back up again. They hit him harder. Still, he got back to his feet. I think because of this, they let him live.
And I remind you of him?
Standing man. Standing man.
That was from the trailer for Bridge of Spies, the newest film from director Steven Spielberg, written by Matt Charman and the Coen brothers, Joel and Ethan Coen. It stars Tom Hanks, Mark Rylance, Amy Ryan, Alan Alda, Austin Sowell, Scott Shepard, Jesse Plemons, and many, many more. The IMDb plot summary of Bridge of Spies reads, an American lawyer is recruited by the CIA during the Cold War to help rescue a pilot detained in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, that's pretty succinct, actually.
That is...
They're getting a lot better at this.
Yeah, I mean it's not very it doesn't really get into in-depth things, but it's the basic plot. Yeah, it's the gist. I mean, it's really the gist of like the second half of the movie.
Yeah, that's a good point.
To the first half.
That's very true. Yes.
So I mean, Bridge of Spies is a movie I was very excited for because there might not be a single person who has had more of an impact on me and my film viewing habits than Steven Spielberg.
Wow.
And in addition to that. It's a movie written by the Coen brothers, who are another like huge film geek thing for me. So
mm-hmm.
Very excited for Bridge of Spies. It's a very interesting concept. I like the idea of this Cold War thriller with Tom Hanks, directed by Spielberg. It's cool seeing Tom Hanks reunite with Spielberg again after like 10 years.
Yeah, in a while.
Yeah. And so, Armie, what's your relationship with Spielberg, with Coen brothers, Mike? I'm assuming it's Good.
It's the same things that you said. Yeah, I mean, who doesn't like Spielberg movies? And who doesn't like Coen Brothers movies?
Yeah, you were like, literally talking about the Coen Brothers earlier in this podcast. So.
Yeah, exactly. So, I was excited for this. I didn't know it was a Coen Brothers movie, actually, or written by them. It's not like their movie, but I didn't know they had written the movie at all until, like, the credits rolled at the end. Yeah. So that was, like, really cool. It was, like, a cool surprise for me. I don't know.
Yeah, very neat. So, overall thoughts on Bridge of Spies, Mike? Go.
It's... I like that. That was good.
Say your thoughts and then we can wrap up. Yeah.
This is the longest episode in our history. It was good. I liked it. Tom Hanks does an amazing job, as always. Everyone's performance is pretty great. The only thing, I don't know if it's not a complaint or anything like that, but I had assumed it was going to be a much more, like, taut political thriller. Not that it was boring, but it was still good. I enjoyed it. I was still, you know, invested in the story. I didn't find any moments where I was, like, holding the armrests or, like, realized that I wasn't breathing. Not that that would happen in, like, a movie like this anyway, but so, like, there was no moments where I was, like, couldn't figure out what was going on. You know what I mean? Like, there was no tense, suspenseful moments for me.
That's interesting. I felt the opposite. I thought,
Interesting.
Well, I thought Bridge of Spies felt like a very expertly crafted thriller that, like, effortlessly feels great. Like, I just...
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
Like, I thought, Spielberg is, like, able to wring tension out of scenes that are as simple as two men, like, talking from other sides of a desk. Like,
right.
Which is, like, 90% of this movie.
Yeah, this movie is a talking movie.
Yeah, it's mostly, like, this movie is mostly about negotiations and about, like, Tom Hanks as this lawyer. The first half of this movie is mostly him, you know, having this trial with Mark Rylance's character, Abel. Mm-hmm. And then the second half of this movie is him trying to negotiate a trade for Abel with this American pilot who's been kidnapped taken prisoner in Russia.
Yes.
As well as this American student who's been taken in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a lot of different layers to this, and you see a lot of calculation going on in Tom Hanks' character's mind, and you see a lot of the different political sides of the spectrum. And I think this movie really brings a lot of it out really well. You know, I just thought it was really great. And the script by the Coen brothers, as well as Matt Charman, but I think, I believe Matt Charman wrote the original draft and the Coen brothers rewrote it. I think that's how it worked. And I thought it, you know, it doesn't feel very, like, Coen-y per se, but it has a lot of...
There's just one scene that I was like, what the fuck is this? And then I saw it was the Coen brothers and was like, oh.
You'll have to mention that scene in spoilers.
Yeah.
But I thought it had a lot of the brothers' dry sense of humor throughout. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was. There were quite a lot of, like, very funny...
Yeah, a lot of very funny moments, particularly between the relationship between Tom Hanks' character and Mark Rylance' character.
Yes.
And so I really enjoyed Bridge of Spies. I thought it was a really expertly crafted thriller that was maybe, like, one of Spielberg's best movies of the last decade. I'm not going to say one of his absolute best because he's made so many movies that are, like, the best of all time. But
yeah.
But you know, of the last, like, since 2000, you know, he's made a lot of great movies since 2000. But I think this is up there as one of the best. Is what I'm saying.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
I thought you were going to follow that up. But
well, it's just kind of interesting that. We are on opposite ends on the thriller thing. That's pretty weird to me.
Yeah, it's odd because we both like the movie.
Yeah. Now I'm like wondering like what I did wrong in viewing this movie.
Well, you didn't. We can have different opinions, Mike. It's okay.
Yeah, but I feel weird now.
But yeah, I mean, so what'd you think of the performances? Like Hanks, I thought was great.
Hanks was great. Yeah.
Yeah. Mark Rylance, I thought stole the show. I thought he was phenomenal.
Yeah. Definitely, he's definitely the best performance of the film as Abel. There was just a couple moments, like, or not moments, but like the pilot. I can't remember his name. Powers, right?
Yeah,
is the
yeah.
character's name. I feel like we just get a very like precursory look at what his experience is.
Okay. Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, this is mostly the story of Tom Hanks, so I feel like everything that happens with the pilot is, like, as much as you need to know.
That's true.
It kind of would have been nice to get more of a glimpse into the pilot's life and, like, you know, why he's doing the things he's doing and, like, how he ended up in his situation. But at the same time, this is really Tom Hanks' movie, and it's more about the negotiation rather than about
character. Jim Donovan rather than that guy.
Yes.
That's true. Yeah, that was cool. It was also interesting to see, his transition from, whoa, I'm just an insurance lawyer, to, like, high-powered government negotiator. Like, because at the end of the film, it tells us that he, like, negotiated the Bay of Pigs the release of prisoners after that from Cuba, which was really cool. I don't know. I liked it. I thought Hanks was amazing, as always.
Yeah, I think, I feel like, I really like Tom Hanks as an actor, but he's a very, like, I think he's a very specific presence.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you'd always, like, just, it always feels like you're watching Tom Hanks. Like, it's not necessarily like you're watching a character. Like, you're always watching Tom Hanks. And
you're watching Tom Hanks as that character.
But I think that happens the least in the movies that are directed by Steven Spielberg.
That's interesting, yeah.
Or, like, I think he's actually a really great actor. I don't know why that is. He just feels like the ultimate, like dad actor, I guess.
I was going to say, he's got a very high dad factor, and, like, yeah. I just kind of want to hang out with him.
Yeah, like, I went to see this movie with my dad, because
it was so did I.
a Cold War thriller starring Tom Hanks, directed by Steven Spielberg.
Yep, good point.
But I did really enjoy it, and I think, I was discussing the movie with my friend Nick Newman, who works for the Film Stage, and, I was talking to him about this a couple weeks ago, because he saw it a little while back, and he was saying the opening of this movie really reminded him of Alfred Hitchcock in certain ways. He was saying it was Spielberg homaging Hitchcock in a way that nobody really homages Hitchcock. You know, when you think of, like, Hitchcock, like, a lot of people will homage him doing, like, the Psycho, like, shower scene or whatever.
Yeah.
But this was, like, you know, the opening of this movie is, like, that train sequence where he's, like, running back and forth on the train, and it's, like, this, like, kind of, like, spy thriller moment.
Oh, yeah.
It feels very Hitchcockian.
Abel's being followed by the FBI, those guys?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. And, I mean, even just the cinematography of that sequence, like, it reminds me a lot of, just walking through, like, the streets and the buildings and stuff. It looked a lot like Rear Window, I thought. Like,
right.
Very similar to that. So, you know, I thought that was pretty cool, too.
Yeah, I like that.
Like, that was on my mind when I was watching it, because I was talking to my friend about it.
I do like the inclusion of the sniffles and the cold. That was, like, a really cool device to use, because Abel has it in the, like, throughout his whole set, the trial and all that stuff. He's always sniffling, wiping his nose with a handkerchief. And then, you know, as soon as Tom Hanks gets to East Germany, you know, to effectively, you know, do espionage kind of type of situation, he immediately gets a cold also.
Yeah.
and then by the end of the sequence, that whole section of the film, Agent Hoffman, the other FBI or CIA agent, also has a cold.
True.
So I thought that was, like, a really cool just little device to use to show that, like, they're similar, they're humans, and, you know, it was being an espionage person, being a spy gives you a cold, apparently.
Yep. I thought the cinematography of this movie was great. It's by Janusz Kaminski, who does most of Spielberg movies. So it's usually great, but I thought it worked really well here. And again, he's mostly shooting, like, people in rooms. Like,
yeah, we got one Spielberg zoom, or whatever that effect is called, when somebody, like, turns around and zoom in on their face of wonder. I can't remember what that's called now.
I'm curious what scene you're referring to, actually.
It happens right in the beginning, and now I can't remember it. I remember it happening and being like, hey. We sort of get it at the end when they're watching, when the family's watching.
Yes, yeah, and I'll get to that in spoilers, because I did want to mention that scene. Mm-hmm. But I also think this is also the first Spielberg movie without a John Williams score since The Color Purple. Presumably John Williams is a little bit busy on
on those eight other movies.
On a certain, little-known sci-fi franchise.
Yeah. I don't know if you heard of it.
Yeah. and Thomas Newman is the guy who did the score for this movie, and I thought it was really good. I thought it was very effective.
Yeah, I would agree.
I did think that I had this problem with Lincoln, and I think this movie has a similar problem. There is a perfect shot for this movie to end on,
mm-hmm.
and I think it just keeps going for another couple minutes.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really need to. And I'll say what that is in spoilers, but I think it's just like this one moment that would have been like the perfect spot to end it.
Would have been great.
And it just goes on for another couple minutes. And Lincoln did the same thing. Lincoln has this perfect shot where, Lincoln gets up and he's like leaves to go to Ford's Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's this perfect shot of him like perfectly framed in the doorway. And he's like walking down the hallway and the movie could have like faded to black and gone to credits.
Yeah.
It would have been perfect. But instead it keeps going and you see like the aftermath of Lincoln getting shot and there's like his, I think he's saying the Gettysburg Address and, you know, it's just a little too much.
it hams it up a little bit.
Yeah. And I think this movie, does that as well. But, otherwise I think this movie is a really solid or just really incredible time. I think it is better than Lincoln, overall. And I think it's, one of his best movies, of the past decade, with the exception of maybe, I don't know, The Adventures of Tintin. I mean, I really loved The Adventures of Tintin, so it's
okay. All right, fair enough.
I really enjoyed this movie. So, is there anything else you want to talk about before we get into spoilers?
No, we can move on to spoilers.
Okay,
I'll try to remember what that scene was, but I'm not sure I can.
Okay, well, try to remember the other scene, the Coen Brothers E.
Oh no, I remember that one. I meant the Spielberg Zoom or whatever it's called.
Okay. All right, and let's move on to spoilers for Bridge of Spies, starting right now. All right, we're doing spoilers for Bridge of Spies starting right now. So the shot that I was referring to, that this movie could have like ended on a perfect note, is at the very end when the negotiation takes place and the trade takes place, and Abel goes off. Like, it's the final shot of Tom Hanks watching Abel leave, and.
Yep.
Camera like cuts out to like an overhead shot of the bridge, and it's like the silhouette of Tom Hanks watching as like a car pulls away.
Yeah,
and that would have been an incredible shot to end the movie on.
That would have been really cool. Yeah, right.
And instead, it just keeps going for a little while to show Hanks returning home to his family.
Yeah,
and you see the family like reacting to like, "Wow, you did all this," because they didn't even know that he was in.
They didn't know. Yeah, and they find out on the evening news.
Yeah, they see it on the evening news conveniently.
Right.
And, you know, then there's the text that says, like, oh, this is what happened. Abel survived and, like, all of this.
Yeah.
And it just feels very extraneous.
Sure.
And it feels like it's very Spielberg. It feels very sentimental and, like,
yep.
Spielberg-y. But, you know, I feel like it would have been a stronger ending if it had ended there. Because then the fate of Abel would have been up to, like, the audience almost. Because
you know what he says before that,
right?
He says if I'm shown the back, look, if I'm embraced or shown the back seat or whatever.
Yeah, and so that would imply that Abel would, you know, possibly be dead. Possibly be killed by
I feel like we get those that ending and also the one in Lincoln that you mentioned, just by virtue of the fact that these are like historical pieces and they're like. Things actually happen, so Spielberg feels the need to tell us. Although Lincoln, I feel like we know what's happening. Like, you don't need to...
yeah, maybe. But
For this one, I feel like that's why we get the text over at the end.
Yeah, I'm also just... it's just a little bit of a diatribe, but in most cases, I think text at the end of the movie is the worst.
Ever since The Boy in Blue, you're scarred.
It wasn't just that. But like even when I was watching it... I mean... When it's a true story like this, it's fine, usually. Although, again, in this case, I feel like the ambiguity of Abel's fate would have been better.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't necessarily need to know that Hanks' character became the base negotiator or that the character that he negotiated to bring back to America died in a plane accident or something.
And the guy is now, like, the professor emeritus or whatever college.
Yeah, like, I don't necessarily need to know that. That's not really relevant to the story that I was being told.
But how else are we going to get the symbolism of Tom Hanks riding the subway and those kids hop in the fence and they don't get shot in America, but they got shot in Germany? How else are we going to get that scene, Mike?
I suppose, yeah. But, I mean, text at the end of a movie. At the end of a true story movie, I sort of get why they would do it.
Right.
But I feel like in most cases it's usually pretty unnecessary. And when it's a fictional story, I think it's the worst.
I would agree with the fictional story.
Because I'm going to... bring up Unbreakable again, but Unbreakable ends with text.
Really? Does it really?
Yeah, like Samuel Jackson reveals himself to Bruce Willis. They have like the 2-minute thing where Samuel Jackson looks shouting at him.
Yeah.
And then it like fades to black and there's text like, oh, Samuel Jackson's character was brought to the you know, the insane asylum, Bruce Willis turned him in, and it's like, why didn't you show me that? Like,
right. Yeah, in a fictional story, I agree with you. It's a pretty cheap like cop out to end the story.
Yeah.
But I feel like, you know, in this situation, it's a little more forgivable, where it's like, this is what happened to these real characters.
Yes, I think, it's fine here, but I think it is just unnecessary. I think, you know, it's very rare that, I think with most true story movies, you'll find text at the end, and usually, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I feel like an example of when it does work, I think, is The Social Network, where it's like, you use kind of like a sarcastic footnote at the end of the, at the end of the movie, but.
Right.
You know, here, I don't think it's totally relevant to the story that was being told.
Right.
Is what I was saying. Now, what was the scene you were referring to that was the Coen Brothers-esque scene?
So it takes place in the East German part of the film when Tom Hanks' character goes to speak to the district attorney of East Germany or whatever.
Yeah.
And he's got, like, all the phones and, like, all the papers all over the table, and there's, like, the little guy taking a memo in the back. And, like, the phone rings, and he answers it, like, really ceremoniously, and answers the wrong phone. And he's like, oh, hold on. And he, like, picks up the other phone. I was like, what is this, like, weird slapstick comedy? Well, not slapstick. It's, like, weird comedy section that's happening right now for a couple of seconds. And he's, like, is a very oddly animated, like, written character, the way he's speaking and stuff, and, like, slamming the table as he talks. I was like, what is going on? And then I saw it was co-written by the Coen Brothers. I was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I feel like the script goes a long way to making the story work, because I feel like, in addition to Spielberg's direction, because I feel like this could be like a very dry story. Like, this could be something this could easily be super boring.
Because
most of the movie is just Tom Hanks, like, talking to people behind the desk. That's, like, the general gist of the movie. And so I think, but the Spielberg's direction works really well, and I think the Coen Brothers script has enough, like, humor, and it has a lot of, like, you know, good character dynamics to make it, like, really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that scene didn't, like, you know, it stood out as a scene that's didn't fit in with the rest of the movie, but not in a negative way. Like, it didn't take away from the rest of the movie because this stood out. It just had a very different attitude to it. But it was a nice break, I guess. Like you said, though, there is a lot of, you know, Abel, the recurring joke of Jim Donovan saying to Abel, you don't look worried. And he keeps asking, would it help? Like, you know, that recurring joke, like stuff like that was pretty funny.
Yes. All right. And can you remember the other scene that you want to talk about? The
Spielberg face or whatever?
Yeah.
No, I can't remember it. Okay. I'm not sure. But I just remember at one point there was like a zoom and somebody looks shocked or wonder, and I was like, oh, there it is. Got it. Check that off the list.
Yes. I guess that about wraps up our thoughts on Bridges of Spies, right? I think we're both pretty big fans of the movie. I really enjoyed it.
It was a positive experience. I liked it. It's a good film. It didn't thrill me, I guess.
All right. Well, that is it for Film Bookcast. Where can we find you online this week, Mike?
Find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog.
And you can find me at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog, as well as all of my podcasting stuff at filmbook.com, where I podcast about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Arrow, and something else.
Walking Dead?
Not anymore. That's a different show. Gotham is the one. Yeah.
Teamwork.
I always draw a blank on whatever podcast I do. I do so many, you know, it's hard to keep track.
Look at you.
All right, guys, thank you for listening to Film Bookcast. If you're listening to this review of your podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to our podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you are emailing about in the title of your email. We produce so many different ones, it's hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now, join us next week for the next episode of The Complete Works, where Mike and I will discuss Nicolas Cage's role in Francis Ford Coppola's Peggy Sue Got Married. So I'm pretty excited about that. That should be fun.
Yeah, I've heard that's good. I've never seen it before.
Neither have I. So I'm excited. And
you're going to learn something new.
New Francis Ford Coppola movie that I haven't seen, so neato. And now check out the next Film Bookcast in 2 weeks, where Mike and I will probably be reviewing the new James Bond movie, Spectre.
Oh, hell yeah. Yep.
So I'm really fucking excited for Spectre. I don't know about you.
Yeah. As if my reaction wasn't indication enough.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm excited.
Yeah, really excited. I think Skyfall was great. and Sam Mendes is returning for this, so you know, I have high hopes. Christoph Waltz is the villain, so it's like how can I not be?
How can it not be good?
Yeah, how can I not be excited for the movie where like a guy who is basically a Bond villain in real life is actually going to be is actually going to be the Bond villain? So
yes, I'm so pumped.
Definitely, really excited for that. So thank you so much for listening, guys, and we are out.